everybody. Welcome to episode 105 of the Alexis L podcast. Now, I have previously said that if I ever went on Celebrity Mastermind, my specialist questions would be firstly, the Sword of Honor novels of Evelyn Waugh, the Sword of Honor trilogy, and then if I made it through to the next round, Weapons of World War II. But I realized that the other area of obsession that I have and have had for, I think certainly since lockdown and probably before, is corruption in the Labour Party. So if I was going to go on Celebrity Mastermind, I would, my first topic now would be corruption within the right wing of the Labour Party. That would be my specialist subject. So therefore, this is a book that I have been anticipating for a very long time. I think it's been quite a long time coming. It is Paul Holden's The Fraud, and I am very excited to have Paul Holden with me today. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. This is more exciting than if I had Kenny Dalglish on or... Tupac Shakur. The late Tupac Shakur. It's more exciting for me personally to have you on. Tupac Shakur. I know who he is. Fuck off. So, Paul, tell me really about the, and I know this book has been in the works for a long time. Just give us a rundown of why you wanted to write it. And then, who you are, how you, everything. Tell me everything.
Tell me everything. A story starts on a dark and stormy night in 1983 in Johannesburg.
In Johannesburg, when I was a driving instructor. So
thank you for having me. I'm Paul Holden. I'm originally from South Africa. I grew up in Johannesburg, but I've been living in the UK for about 15 years now. In that period of time, I've been working as an anti-corruption investigator, investigative journalist, generally focusing on sort of what we'd call grand corruption. So looking at sort of very high-level political corruption. I got my start in this work back in 2006, 2007, because at the time I was investigating this notoriously corrupt arms deal that South Africa had signed. With the BAE Systems and a whole bunch of European suppliers that really massively undermined the post-apartheid democratic order and sort of created the conditions for what eventually became this phenomenon we call state capture in South Africa. And at that time, I was working, investigating this deal, which implicated all sorts of presidents and senior
figures.
This
was also the reason that Andrew Feinstein resigned from the... ANC government, is it?
That's right, yeah. So that I actually met Andrew Feinstein around about that time in my early 20s, and he was, I was investigating the deal that he had been trying to investigate in Parliament and been effectively forced out of Parliament and then effectively forced out of South Africa for investigating.
Yeah, it's interesting, just to sort of jump in, it's interesting that yesterday on all our mainstream media, we had this kind of farce where there was a committee that said that a parliamentary committee that said that Britain was literally defenseless against an invasion from Russia. And then there were some other people who were saying, what struck me was some people said, well, that's true, but we're dealing with it. But everybody talked as if rearmament and the arms industry and was absolutely a good thing. Mm. Nobody was there on the mainstream media to state, the opposite, that in fact it was a bad thing. And so I think we're seeing a kind of similar level of state capture in this country, I think, and in Europe in general.
Think that, when, the work that me and Andrew have done, basically I joined Andrew, in 2009-2010. I worked with him on a book called The Shadow World. And ever since then, we've been working on militarism and state capture and the defense sector. The defense industry is, first of all, one of the most corrupt industries in the world, notorious for its ability to bribe decision makers in multiple different countries. There was this phenomenal study that was done in the sort of the early 2000s, they calculated that roughly 40% of all corruption in global trade was related to the defense sector. And then here you have, you know, an incredibly powerful defense lobby that sort of the self-licking ice cream cone that spends vast amounts of money convincing everyone that everything is incredibly dangerous and that there's a new threat on the horizon. And surprisingly, the new threat on the horizon can be solved with all the old things that we used to buy, still need to buy, which is defense equipment. And it's, you know, with this new government, with the Labour government, they're pushing it an open door because it is now sort of fundamental to the Labour Party's sort of internal thinking. And we can talk about that a bit more, but they've now gotten themselves into this position. They sort of manufactured this place in their thinking where they believe that they're going to deliver, that sort of the core feature of their economic growth path is going to be spending money on defense, which is, frankly, from an economic point of view, if you spend any time looking at the economics of defense, just risible, just utterly
ludicrous,
Because defense spending produces far fewer jobs than other industries. It doesn't really produce.
And it doesn't do any. It doesn't. Yeah, yeah. I always say if you make a tractor, it plows the land. It grows. Yeah, the best case scenario with a tank is it just fucking sits there and rusts. You know,
And it creates a condition where you actually can. You know, the perverse situation we're in now is that decisions are being made to make us sort of fundamentally more unsafe by directing. Yes. Money away from foreign aid and away from the development budget into military spending. So, well, part of the issue we're dealing with right now is instability around the world caused by those things that the foreign aid budget was helping to ameliorate. And, you know, it's sort of a dispiriting turn, and it's a dispiriting but not unexpected turn. This is the safe place of the Blairite Labourite in the end. Which is to basically say, yes, we'll just spend vast amounts of money on defense equipment that will be delivered late. It'll be massively overcost. By the time it's actually delivered, it'll be obsolete.
Yeah. I mean, the new Ajax fighting vehicle has just started to make its way to the army units. It's 8 years late, and each unit costs £10 million for a thing. I don't know whether they've solved the problems, but when it was first tested, it made everybody inside it throw up because of the vibration.
I mean, it is the defining feature of the arms sector, generally speaking, to overpromise and underdeliver and cost everybody an absolute fortune.
Yeah,
and there's no comeuppance for it because, you know, these are strategic suppliers. You can't actually find them. You can't, you know, stop their procurement.
Yeah.
And if you do, you know, you'll be hammered in the press. And behind the scenes, they're doing huge amounts of sort of lobby ministers and have sort of massively preferential access at the, you know, the topmost level. I think there was a study that was done. Now I'm pulling statistics out of my head, so I might get it fundamentally wrong. But I remember there was a study that was done a while back that showed it looked at the number of lobbying meetings between, I think it was Rishi Sunak and all companies in the UK. And the number one company meeting Rishi Sunak in that period was BAE Systems. They had the most advanced preferential access to Rishi Sunak. So they just, you know, there is this, you know, there's a revolving door. I mean, there's actually this great report that was done by some of our friends at the Campaign Against the Arms Trade. And they said, you know, this idea of a revolving door is nonsense. There's no such thing as a revolving door. What actually you have is an open plan office between the defense sector and government. Yeah. And there's just people who just sort of cross these boundaries that don't really even exist anymore between being in the military, sort of high level in the military, and then going to go work for a defense company and then going to advise the government on buying the defense company's equipment.
Yeah.
None of which in the end generally tends to make us any more safer than we were if we just actually spent the money more wisely on mitigating its climate change and natural
things. Yeah, makes a fuck a lot for it. So then, so tell us how this work led you to write this book about the election of Keir Starmer to the leadership of the Labour Party and then his subsequent.
I mean, so at a personal level, I moved to the UK 2009-2010. Generally speaking, I was a Labour supporter. You know, I arrived, even though I didn't particularly necessarily like everything they did. You know, I voted for the Labour Party in all the elections when I arrived. You know, I voted for Gordon Brown. I voted for Ed Miliband. I got more involved when Jeremy Corbyn was elected. And part of the reason I got so involved at the time, or at least more supportive in my own mind, and a bit more aware of what was going on in the party, was because actually the Corbynite surge in the party heralded this like really quite dramatic and interesting change about how they approached corruption and anti-corruption and tax havens, all these really exciting proposals. But in 2021, so I got to know the party a bit more. I got a bit more embroiled in it, in sort of got a sense of how, and like for a lot of left-wing people, also progressive people, had the same experience of thinking, oh, this is an exciting moment. I'm gonna you know, become part of a Labour Party. I'm gonna try involve myself. And then suddenly you go to a meeting and you met with this sort of suspicion and hostility. You know, this is not what I expected. Yes. I thought that in the end we'd all be on the same side.
I mean, that's the thing that I often talk about is going, you know, Linda joined the party at the same time as you did, and just the sheer unpleasantness of those right-wing people and hostility towards the new members. And, of course, it was because you were coming in and partly you were coming in and taking over this kind of their fucking their club, I suppose, their train set. But yeah, rather than having a collegiate and comradely attitude, they, you know, even on the, you know, the individual level, these people were just repulsively arrogant and unpleasant. I remember Linda going to some fundraiser early on with a friend of ours who was dying of cancer, and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't. We sit here. That's our seat, you know, just on that level, really, of kind of human compassion and decency. It's completely lacking in those people, I think, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, the sad reality is that, you know, the book tells a story about how those people won, really.
Yeah.
And the consequences of that, which is that if you're going to, you know, you now look at what this, you know, those branch meetings or whatever, what people go to around the country, were packed with people, and it was, you know, might have been ugly, but it was also dynamic and it was interesting. You had lots of conversations, and, you know, there was movement and there was energy and there was people knocking on doors and there was a ground game. I mean, now, like, even a place like Holborn and St. Pancras, like the Labour Party at a ground level, like, has basically ceased to exist. Really? There's like really, you know, pretty pathetic levels of you know, people going out and door knocking and canvassing. It's really just like you look at their photos and it's these depressing collections of you know, a huddled group of Labour councillors and a couple of hanger-ons. But the reason I got into the book was you know, sort of very opportunistically and very and sort of out of the blue, I got access to this, to like this absolutely incredible cachet of documents out of the Labour Party in about late 2021, early 2022. And I thought at the time when I got this cachet of documents that I'd be seeing precisely this sort of stuff, the sort of, you know, internal minutiae of Labour Party battling, which is interesting in and of itself because you know, it's this, the cut and thrust of our politics. But actually it was my partner Jess, who I worked with very closely and is an incredible researcher. We were looking through all this material and she came across, you know, what really triggered this start to it was that she came across this email, this set of emails about this organization called Labour Together, which at the time, you know, we had no idea who Labour Together were. They seemed like pretty small, anodyne. Turns out they're actually this like really fundamental vehicle that was used by a guy called Morgan McSweeney, who's now the chief of staff of the Prime Minister, to do two things. One is to destroy, secretly run this incredible campaign of dishonesty and misdirection, to destroy the capacity of the Corbynite leadership to succeed, really undermine the prospects of the Labour Party winning in 2019 as a precondition to installing their chosen replacement as leader, which was Keir Starmer. But the thing that we discovered in this, you know, that Jess discovered was this email where I think it's an aide or an assistant to Steve Reid MP, who's now the Minister for Housing, who was very close to Morgan McSweeney.
Particular idiot, yeah.
And he was saying, you know, this email basically said, you know, Labour Together has been doing all this stuff, including Labour Together has been involved in this campaign against anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And we were just struck by this because we were like, well, what on earth are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense. There's nothing in the public domain, nothing that Labour Together has ever said that would indicate that you guys have been involved in the anti-Semitism crisis. I mean, there was even at one stage in 2019, Labour Together did this like takeover of Labourlist where they had all these people writing articles for Labourlist. Not the anti-Semitism was not mentioned in those articles, right? So The question then became, well, if you're involved in the anti-Semitism crisis, why does nobody know about it? And what were you actually doing? And basically me and Jess started pulling this thread, and we started realizing how central Labour Together, Morgan McSweeney, was both to the project to undermine Corbynism, but then also the project to install Keir Starmer's leader. And then effectively now, I think he largely runs the government. And we've just literally seen this week that, you know, one of his closest political allies in this project was Shabana Mahmood, who's now the Home Secretary. Yeah. And you know, she's announced these like horrific, absolutely horrific crackdowns on asylum seekers. Really, yeah. Farage-ist in tone and content.
They have to sell their jewellery, which is very... I mean, you feel they're kind of tone-deaf because they live in such a kind of enclosed world, but that is so redolent of, you know, Jewish, people being sent to the concentration camps having their jewellery and taken off them. You know, they don't even see the kind of parallels, really.
Yeah, I think, you know, partially the cruelty is the point.
Right. Okay.
Cruelty is you know this announcement, which is really, you know, a Morgan McSweeney plan. It's part of his strategy for how the Labour Party wins the next election.
Right.
Which is to they need to pretend to be reform on certain key cultural issues and around immigration, park their tanks in their lawn, potentially outflank reform on the right if you can get there. So that, you know, and the theory is that at that point you'll get some Labour to reform switches back, or you'll make sure that the reform can't sort of draw any distance between you and them. The problem is that the vast majority of people who vote for the Labour Party, historically, the vast majority, I'd say at least half of the people who voted for the Labour Party in 2024, the vast majority, I mean, really the vast majority of its own members, and actually quite a few of the people who were the sort of a centrist persuasion who'd backed Starmer are just absolutely horrified by this stuff.
Yes.
You know, it's like a real, real red line. And, you know, he probably doesn't...
I mean,
doesn't...
are they that stupid that they think they've... I mean, I suppose they were right in that you know, it's that... Where else are they going to go? They have nowhere else to go. The calculation is that people will vote for Labour to stop reform under any circumstances, and that a left alternative will never emerge, which is obviously starting to not be the case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the sense that they can shed certain types of voters and still maintain a majority, and that's actually it's part of like an explicit methodology that they developed. So I talk in the book, you know, there was this report that was written in 2023 by Labour Together, which basically was at that stage was working very closely with McSweeney to develop the strategy for how the Labour Party is going to win that election, and it's just really, I mean, I think it's such a fascinating document. It's such a distillation of like everything that's wrong with this political methodology that sort of guided McSweeney, but also, you know, explains why our government right now is so deeply unpopular. And basically what it does, you know, what it does is it looks at the population, it splits the whole population of the UK into six different segments and says, you know, in order for us to win a majority, like this massive majority, these are six segments of the population. We need to win two of them. We need to win, four of them in total. Two of them, yeah, and they list them all. And basically what it comes down to is that the people that don't matter in terms of voting for them because they're going to vote for them anyway or they're in safe seats are sort of centrist dads, basically, and progressives. Like basically they say in their report, these people don't matter because electorally at the moment they're in safe seats or they're going to vote for us anyway. So what we need to do is to basically win over these other segments of the population, and we do that by turning right on all sorts of policy.
There's no conception or idea that this might be morally wrong.
You know, well, there's two things that are really interesting. One, you read that document, there's no sense, first of all, whether it's ethical.
Yeah.
Right? There's no sense of like, you know, so they talk about immigration, for example, and it's clear that even in that document, they're sort of playing around with the idea of our flanking the Tory party on the right on immigration at that point, which is already, the Tory party is in the Rwanda scheme and stuff like that. So there's no sense of like, this is ethical, whether it's not ethical. That's not even a consideration. It's also, there's no consideration of whether that's actually workable or whether this is how you do government.
Yeah.
This is actually a practical solution for how you govern. All it is really is, we're going to interview a whole bunch of people. We're going to find out what they want. We're going to reflect back what they want at them, regardless of whether it actually makes any sense whatsoever. Regardless of actually the long-term political impact, what it'll do is it'll make us win this election. And what it actually does, you know, and then that methodology is carried through in the general election in 2024. And you look at, you know, it's reflected in the manifesto where they make all sorts of, you know, promises that they can never keep because the promises they make are totally unrealistic. about, you know, if you're actually going to govern after 14 years of austerity. If you look at that manifesto, it's a joke. It is like, it's a bad joke, because that manifesto was like tinkering at the absolute edges of like a fundamentally dysfunctional country after 14 years of austerity. And they're like, we can fix this country by moving some spending we were going to use on like the rerouting of a particular A road. Literally, it's what it says in the manifesto, you know. None of that stuff is nonsense. It was total rubbish, right? You know, we won't raise taxes during the life of this parliament. Well, how are you going to deal with the fact that, you know, you this is 14 years of austerity and growth is sluggish? This is not serious stuff. But it was designed to win that election, and it's also a big reason why they're so unpopular now. And it's a big reason why, you know, and that was done, that methodology was done when it was very clear that it was a two-horse race. It was basically Tories and Labour.
Yeah.
Now it's not a two-horse race anymore, precisely because they've got this methodology. It's now a five-horse race in certain constituencies, right?
Yeah.
And the Labour Party is just absolutely losing support to the left, which, you know, could very realistically in the next year, as a result of all this stuff, actually starts surpassing it in the polls. And then the Labour Party strategy is really screwed, because the Labour Party strategy is, it's either, you know, vote for us or get reform, but they're actually the third or the fourth party in certain seats. People will vote for somebody else to stop reform.
Yeah. I mean, the book is published, and there's a particularly, I'm sure you're aware of it, particularly, I thought, you know, if you're a fan of these things, there was a particularly remarkable incident on Newsnight, was it last week or the week before? So there's a panel there. One of them is Barry Gardner, kind of flamboyant, but, you know, left wing, obviously, remain loyal to Corbyn. Another is this character called Maurice Glassman. Maurice Glassman is sprawled on the couch. I've come across his name before, but never. He's wearing he's sort of got a suit on, but also a kind of jumper. And he's very kind of, I mean, his body language is very, is very arrogant, really, in a way. Anyway, so at some point, Barry Gardner says, you know, there are two books which are fundamental to understanding Keir Starmer and the Keir Starmer project. One is Pogrund and Maguire's Get In, and the other book is Paul Holden's The Fraud. Now, Maurice Glassman at this point has already, I think, said that the project Labour Party was to get rid of all these racist left-wing lunatics, by which he meant the Corbyn administration. But then he says, Get In is very good, but the fraud is, the fraud is left-wing conspiracy theories. Mm. I was there. And, you know, it's a dishonest, I can't remember the actual words you used, dishonest, or, you know. Well, of course you fucking reject it, because you're part of the, he's blue Labour, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Obviously a Zionist as well. You know, you're front and centre of this conspiracy, really. Mm-hmm. But it was, I mean, for Newsnight, I thought it sort of kind of jumped out, really. I mean, but, you know, it jumped out as a real exchange rather than, you know, the usual kind of anodyne swapping of kind of talking points. So, I mean, I don't know, you reflect on that, really.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
I mean, first of all, there's so many different things to unpack there. I mean, so the first thing I've got to say is being attacked by Maurice Glassman, I think, might be like one of the greatest endorsements of my life.
So that was their immediate uptick in sales.
The immediate uptick, honestly, seeing Maurice Glassman attack me, and like I had the biggest smile on my face. I was like, I've done something right in my life if Maurice Glassman doesn't like me.
Yeah.
I mean, Maurice Glassman, you know, he is the thinker, and I use that word advisedly, because he's, you know, I really don't really rate what he has to say, but he's the thinker and the founder behind the sort of the Blue Labour movement.
It reminded me a bit of, you know, this is the Witches of Eastwick, if you remember this. I think it's John Updike. The character of the devil played by Jack Nicholson, this you don't see for a while. He really, I mean, attractive in a way, but also redolent of kind of malice, really. I just thought he was really a kind of remarkable figure in a way. I'd never seen it. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, he is the sort of remarkable figure, and I'm not sure that anybody who is part of his political faction is really served by having him talk in public or on Newsnight, because actually, the more people realize he's a bit but some of his views are a bit strange. I mean, he's a big fan of Steve Bannon, for example.
Right.
You know, he's, you know, the Blue Labour thinking, which is really sort of, I think, pretty nutty, is the sort of workerist, anti-welfarist position, but extremely conservative on cultural values, with this idea that what Blue Labour is trying to do is to remake the Labour Party from within as the authentic home of the working class that doesn't give a crap about woke progressive ideas. And of course, you know, running within that is, you know, a strong like pro-Israel approach as well. And it's you know, I find it sort of distasteful at a personal level, like the actual politics that they espouse. But also, I just think it's electorally suicide to basically say to the core, the thing that's interesting about Blue Labour is just the extent to which they have utter contempt for the vast majority of Labour members and a very good number of Labour MPs, who they think are a bunch of liberal wastrels, which is quite something considering, you know, who's left in the Labour Party at this point.
Yeah.
Hardly the most like radical collection of, you know, X, C, and D operatives, right? It's like it's
Pat McFadden, you know, Pat McFadden, yeah. Who's running the morgue while you're on the telly?
Yeah, exactly. So the one hand, I was like, you know, I take that as a great endorsement. I did think it was interesting because, you know, the one thing you don't want to do as an author or as like somebody who produces something is the worst thing to happen to you is to be ignored. So at least I know that I'm part of a conversation. And what I do actually think that conversation reflected is that plainly Maurice Glassman, who was very close to Morgan McSweeney, right? Like extremely close to Morgan McSweeney, to the extent that, you know, last week when there was all that briefing that happened about, you know, where Streeting is running, Maurice Glassman, yeah, and Morgan McSweeney were sitting together for, you know, hours. Before that Newsnight interview, Morgan McSweeney and Maurice Glassman are sitting and talking about this. So, of course, Maurice Glassman's going to, you know, have a line of attack on a book that basically exposes Morgan McSweeney for, you know, the real, frankly, the piece of shit that he is, and why he shouldn't be anywhere near power. But what it did reflect is that plainly this book is being talked about within the Labour Party itself, and plainly it's being talked about in ways that is problematic for Morgan McSweeney. You know, for somebody like Barry Gardiner, who I think would be sympathetic to at least some of the stuff in the book about, you know, the attacks on the faction, to raise this book, and everybody knows that he's talking about, suggests to me that it is actually going, maybe if they even talk about it openly, it's going around like Samizdat behind the scenes. And they're all reading this and be like, geez, I can't believe Morgan did that. I can't believe that Steve Reed did this. While this really actually does reflect something problematic, that this is a really utterly intolerant political faction that's now taken over the Labour Party and is driving us onto the rocks of far-right, Farageist immigration policy as our polls tank completely, and they've installed this prime minister who is the least popular prime minister since polls began. Like, yes. The thing that they can't deny is that this book, even if they disagree with it necessarily, at least it actually provides an explanation for how we got there. It has a coherent, cogent theory. I mean, as the, you know, I will say this, Maurice Glassman said it was inaccurate. He didn't say what was inaccurate about it. I mean, this book is, you know, I stand by this book 100%.
I mean, extraordinary, like, meticulous so research. Yeah.
And there are so many footnotes that we had to put them online because it would add another 150 pages to the book, right? So,
yeah. I mean, I'm somebody, obviously, who abhors research and, you know, would rather make stuff up, which is, you know, which is kind of my job, you know, so that's fine. But, you know, I am in awe of the kind of granular level of research that you have put in and your people have put in on this book. I think, yeah, as you say, it's remarkable, really. And that's why they can't refute it, can they? Because it's so meticulous. Yeah.
No, I mean, and we were, you know, so you know, obviously, me and Jess have been working on this for, you know, for a very long time, digging into loads and loads of material. Lots of stuff was cut out as well, I should say. So there's still more stuff to come out. But
you're going to do that as another book, or you're going to, like,
I like the idea of a series called like the Cutting Room Floor or something like that. Doing a series of articles of just little stories. You know, some of them are a bit silly, some of them are a bit more serious. Just that I think fleshes out some of the nature of this particular political faction and the project and how they behave and the sort of the total lack of principle or ethical compass behind, you know, a lot of what they do. But we were terrified. We were really genuinely very, very, very worried, and I was very particularly worried about about sort of the legal response to the book, that we'd be sued for libel, yeah. I'd be sued for libel, that and as a result, the book was extensively libel checked. The book was, you know, we had to make it 100% certain. And I think what it meant was, you know, very practically, was that we had to be, well, I had to be extremely disciplined in the way, in what I could say and what I could back up and what I could justify, because I was always extremely nervous about, you know, I don't think it helps your case to overstate it, but B, we had to, you know, constantly I was writing with a lawyer on my shoulder saying, you know, what can you justify? What can you stand up? What do your documents actually say? Don't say anything beyond what the documents actually say. Don't speculate beyond that. So actually, I think the book ends up being slightly more conservative than it could have been. It could have been much more strident, I think, in the approach that we had.
I mean, what do you think about the timing? Because in a way, I mean, you have certainly added to that process, but I know, because I've known this book has been in the works for many years, and in some ways I wanted it to come out before the truth about when Starmer was still riding that wave of popularity, and that it would have then. But maybe this is the perfect moment. Maybe in a way you've been the Starmer project was already starting to fray, was when the book came out. I mean, it was only officially launched, was it, on the 13th of November? I mean, in my mind, it's been out for about 2 years already. But even before it came out, it had resulted in the resignation of two political figures. Is that right? I know Ovenden.
The Paul Ovenden definitely was related to that. There's sort of rumors about other people as well, although it's never been entirely stood up.
All those aides that people have left Downing Street.
And there was, you know, the tension, you know, behind the book was very much that I you know, originally thought I need to write a book. You know, when we started pulling these threads and when we realized what this political project was and really how, like, deeply problematic it was. And it's not just that it's mean-spirited, it's not just that it's unethical, but there's, like, serious governance issues around it. There's, like, proper issues around, like, unlawful conduct about, you know, dirty money, undeclared funds, you know, real issues around, you know, the extent to which the party's already been, you know, aggressively captured by corporate interests, the, you know, the flood of lobbyists that was allowed to happen as a result of the remaking of the party under McSweeney and Starmer. And it was always my intention to warn people. And I was pretty devastated when I realized the book wouldn't come out before the election. And the intention was always to get it out before the election. You know, to basically send the message that, you know, you need to be careful about this guy. And I felt at a personal level, it's pretty distraught that we couldn't let people know enough about this guy and this project before the election. But at the same time, I think looking back on it now and in the conversations that I had and where the media was going, is that this book would have been utterly ignored. I mean, really, nobody wanted to hear that stuff back in
2024. Right, yes, absolutely, yes.
Because there was just this, and correctly so, there was a sense the Tories are absolutely horrific and we just need to get rid of the Tories.
Right.
So people who are now much more sympathetic to the book back then were pretty hostile to it. And I do think that what has helped is that the book has landed, you know, if the book had come out before the election, I would have basically said at the end of the book, like, be warned, it's going to go to crap, right?
Yeah.
Whereas now the book has come out and I'm like, well, look, it's gone to crap.
If
you think it's gone to crap, why has this happened? This book explains it. So it's landed in the point where people have this, like, very profound, even like pretty ordinary people who are not massively politically engaged have a sense of, like, something has gone dreadfully wrong here. Something is not right. We've elected this Labour government and this massive majority, and everybody hates it in like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And it's made none of our lives any better. In fact, if anything, it feels like, I think for most people, it feels like things have stagnated or gotten worse in many respects. So there is, it starts from a position of you know, the book lands in this position where people really have the sense of, well, this political project has really disappointed us. It's not what we thought it was. And it is now, I think, it's deeply embedded in the public consciousness that this that Starmerin himself is personally untrustworthy. And I think what the book does is help people understand that it's not just that Starmerin himself is distrustworthy, but the political project that brought him to power is based on dishonesty.
Who do you think he is? I mean, do you know him or do you know who? Starmerin. I mean, who is he? I mean, I've only met him once at a charity football match. Or anything, right.
I mean, if you listen to him, he's the midfield general of his five-a-side side, right?
Yeah, well, because I met him. I don't know if I've told this story before, but a friend of mine, a very dear friend, is in his plays five-a-side football, and he told me about this guy who was an MP who, even though he had a important shadow cabinet brief, would choose the teams, would book the pitch, would ring round everybody, and which kind of at the time you thought it's very controlling if you're seemed oddly controlled. But then the other thing was that my friend used to have what he called Fish and Chip Friday at their house in Queen's Park, and he said we have this lovely couple, Keir and Victoria, they come over Fish and Chip Friday, and then I go to chip shop in West End Lane and then come back, and it's just absolutely lovely, and you must come over for Fish and Chip Friday. I mean, I can't imagine what would have happened if those two fuckers, if I'd had Fish and Chip Friday. But the only thing was, the only thing that he did, that my friend had a kind of charity football match to celebrate his birthday, and I played, and I think, I can't remember whether I was opposing Starmer or Right, I was just saying, I wish I'd crippled the cunt. I would have saved us all a lot of. I could have maybe passed it off as a sporting injury, But I mean, that was the only time I met him. And he seemed, in retrospect, I mean, he seemed, I don't know, he wasn't thrilled to meet me, really.
Well, I mean, I only met him once very briefly, and obviously we were actually in the same Labour Party branch in Kentish Town.
So yes,
I saw him then, and for me, it was clear even at that stage that within the 2019 the really like rank factionalism that had dominated the party and was replicated locally, that he was on, he was plainly located within the right wing faction there. I mean, from who he is personally, I mean, I think the one thing that's really striking about Keir Starmer is that he doesn't seem to have any what I suppose what people used to call a political economy. That he doesn't have any deep or fundamental sense of why society looks the way it does. He's not a great political thinker. It's interesting. If you read the Tom Baldwin, so there's this long Tom Baldwin book, which is, quite sympathetic to him. Mm. And it's a biography of Starmer. And it's a fascinating read because obviously Tom Baldwin, the book weirdly enough made me like Tom Baldwin, but also feel very sorry for him because clearly Tom Baldwin wants Keir Starmer to be a figure. He wants him to be, he knows he's going to be the next prime minister. He wants him to be another great Labour leader. But actually, if you read the book, it's this like fascinating thing of a biographer who's very sympathetic to him, repeatedly trying to get Starmer to explain who he is. And he's like grasping at smoke. It's like he can't grab this guy. He doesn't exist, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's Man of Soup, I think. I mean, he doesn't exist, really. It's a strangest phenomenon in a way. Just also to going back to the book, there's a weird kind of ground zero geographical location for a lot of this shit, which is bizarrely is Croydon, which Talal tells me is called the Cronks, isn't it? That it's also seen in the bizarre actually nightlife. But Croydon, I mean, just this is I mean, I remember Croydon before London was really before the kind of skyscraper kind of Dubai on the Thames era of London, Croydon. If you were driving back in from France, coming up the A2 or the A20, I can't remember. Croydon was this collection of kind of shiny tower blocks, which looked like Manhattan from — this has got nothing to do with your book, but looked like Manhattan from a distance, really. If you were coming from the South, I would say, that Stevie Wonderland living for the city, you know, New York, just right. like I pictured it, skyscrapers and everything. I would say to Linda in the car, Croydon, just like I pictured it, skyscrapers and everything. But it was just this, I mean, as you got closer, the reality became considerably less romantic. But yeah, I just remember, you know, in the sort of 80s, the 90s, just driving towards Croydon, and there was just this collection of kind of glittering tower blocks. Anyway, this, for some reason, this has become the locus, I can't remember, not locus belli, well, locus belli, I suppose, locus corrupti of the geographical ground zero of Labour corruption. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about
that. By the way, I'm absolutely going to steal locus corrupti, because that is absolutely brilliant. I love that. That is so good. The story of this particular Labour government is the story of Morgan McSweeney and his closest political allies, and his closest political ally for years was Steve Reed, who is now
the idiot with the Build Baby Build MAGA style.
Who before then was refusing to you know, even contemplate nationalizing water. But he's, you know, anybody who watches him on TV recognizes that he's a bit of a mediocrity, but who is really sort of rockets to prominence precisely because he's been at the heart of this political project. And he's always been based in South London. So he was originally in Lambeth, and then he becomes the MP for Croydon. And there's like a whole, basically this Croydon set that operate at the time. So Morgan McSweeney, you know, his first, if you read, you know, all the hagiographies that have been written about him, it's, you know, ground zero for his political awakening is working in sort of Lambeth, working with Stephen and engaging in these pitch battles with the loony crazy left there and seeing them off. And then, you know, when there's an interesting theme there, because obviously Croydon itself, you know, it's sort of been a bit of a marginal territory at a sort of a council level and a municipal level between the Tories and the Labour Party, and the Labour Party sort of took it over around about the time that Steve Reed was rising to prominence as an MP there, and just absolutely ran into the ground, astonishing that you know, it was one of the few, I think one of the only the second ever to effectively declare bankruptcy. And part of the reason I declare bankruptcy, coming back to your point about the skyscrapers in the sky, was because the Croydon Council and the Labour Party had been basically engaging in these like extremely weird baroque schemes to effectively become like almost like a commercial housing developer, making all sorts of like very weird decisions, but effectively just driving the borough into ruin. And that's basically Steve Reed's political allies, right? Steve Reed's political milieu. I tell the story of Inside Croydon, which is that small media outlet Croydon, which I'm now going to write to the editor and suggest that he renames himself Inside Cronks and see what he says to me. he's this great journalist, Stephen Downs, like proper like pound the pavement, get the story, whatever you make, gumshoe, the sort of people we venerate, right, in our imaginings of like what it is to be an investigative journalist. He is that guy, right? Basically his role is to investigate the wrongdoing of Croydon Council, and he just uncovers so much of it, and all the people that he's uncovering, he's involved in those stuff, are all of Morgan McSweeney's political allies and Steve Reed's political allies. So when Morgan McSweeney wins, you know, effectively takes over the Labour Party via Starmer, all of that sort of Croydon methodology and the Croydon approaches, then gets sort of implemented into the Labour Party itself. And like the most obvious example of that is David Evans, who comes in as the general secretary of a Labour Party under McSweeney, effectively at McSweeney's insistence. Starmer actually wanted somebody else altogether, which I think shows the nature of a relationship between these two and who was calling the shots. But, you know, David Evans is again, Croydon, like a Croydon stalwart. He was getting contracts from, you know, his company called the Campaign Company was getting contracts out of the Croydon local council. And Inside Croydon was reporting on, maybe there's conflict of interest here, that sort of stuff. So, and the thing that sort of marked that period is sort of two things. One, it's like hyper-factionism. Like Croydon is like, the level of factionism that I saw in Holborn and St Pancras is nothing compared to what happened in Croydon and South London and Lambeth. It is like, it is blood sport stuff down there. And it's been blood sport stuff for a while. And the second thing is just this like total collection of mediocrities running things into the ground.
Yes.
Which is effectively what happens, you know, which I think is what's happening now, is, you know, this collection of people who don't really know how to govern, don't really have any deep, profound thoughts about how to actually fundamentally make our lives any better, now sitting at the wheel and being exposed for who they are, which is basically a bunch of, you know, political opportunists who have really spent years and years and years confecting this image of themselves as these like hyper competent, you know, deal makers and governors who are really just emperor's new clothes stuff, right? That's what they're being exposed to.
Yeah. That's the other thing is that I mean, I don't know whether that speaks to the nature of our politics, but they're not, because you think of them, I mean, they're evil, that is true, but they are also massively, I mean, they're good at factionalism, I suppose, because of their terrible personalities. They're good at that, but they're not good at anything else at all, really. And Morgan McSweeney obviously is painted in the Pogrund and Maguire book as this fucking genius who managed to get Starmer elected, you know, through his level of kind of political Machiavellian conniving. But when, you know, the entire press and the entire, you know, the power, the entirety of the establishment is willing you into power, it's not so much of a fucking achievement, is it, really?
No, and definitely there's a sense that, you know, that the Labour right wing, and I think there's like a deeper fundamental problem with our politics about the way in which the Labour right wing, at least over the last 30 or 40 years, has played in British politics, is that there's basically no easier position to be in than to be a Labour right wing politician in opposition.
Right.
Because basically what you do is you sort of float around for a bit and you pitch a couple of policies that nobody really tests, nobody actually thinks. You're just sort of flying kites for 3 or 4 years. You've seen, you know, the press treats you with kid gloves because you are the person who is repeatedly punching left-wingers in the face and putting their heads in the toilet. Yeah. And they all think that's great sport and great fun. And then, you know, no matter what, sort of you're actually encouraged the sort of these repeated ritualistic expressions of like factional animosity, which then, you know, plays out in like the way they treat Diane Abbott, for example, which is really just, you know, I think specifically actually designed to humiliate her, designed to humiliate her as a strategy to send a message to both the media and to certain sectors of the voters saying, Diane Abbott is not one of us. We hate her as much as you do. We're going to punish her on your behalf. And there's a sort of collective schadenfreude amongst these set when they see that happening. I will say, you know, the one thing, you know, McSweeney is very good at certain things. I'll give him that. So I think he is almost unparalleled in his ability to work the media to place narratives that are helpful to his political objectives and to do so entirely behind the scenes without any disclosure. Right. And the extent to which he effectively drives the role that he's played in forming our sort of commonly understood political narratives around things like anti-Semitism, but also even like more recently.
We should put anti-Semitism in inverted commas, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Never will say it.
But the you know, the way in which they, you know, he does have an incredible ability to create media narrative that helps his political objective. I think that's actually his superpower. I mean, I think it's not a good thing. I think it's generally a pretty despicable thing because, you know, quite often when you actually look at the stories that he places in the media, you actually look at them a bit more deeply. They don't really hold up, and there's all sorts of problems with them. This idea that he is, like that he has a unique finger on the pulse of the country is clearly rubbish. And it's clearly rubbish because he's produced the leader who's the chief of staff to who's the least popular prime minister since 1977, since records began. Yeah. Like the proof is in the pudding, right? The proof is in the pudding is that this guy is absolutely hated. This political project is falling apart. That a guy who's just won 400 seats is basically the Walking Dead. And everybody basically realizes that Morgan McSweeney is part of the reason for that. So that sort of narrative of him being this like great strategic genius who has, you know, he's the vote whisperer, he's the working class whisperer, that's nonsense. I mean, they really, you know, he was extremely good at creating media narratives. He is unparalleled, along with his allies, in being utterly brutal in internal party democracy issues around factionism, precisely because they actually just don't like democracy at all. They don't think democracy is a good thing. I would actually say that one of the hallmarks of this political project is it's not that it's undemocratic, it's actually anti-democratic. You know, it doesn't.
And that was because one of the things which I mentioned in, I think, series four of Sandwich Bomb, my Radio 4 series, was this Starmer's membership of this thing called the Trilateral Commission, which nobody ever picked up on, the only MP to be. I know you don't really mention it either, but this is essentially an organization of US oligarchs who believe that democracy is not a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, I don't focus on the Trilateral Commission because I still don't understand it, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
And partially because actually I think the story of Starmer is the story of McSweeney, who I think is actually more.
He's not even British, is he, McSweeney? He's actually Irish.
He's Irish. He was born in Ireland. He has a very interesting family history. I encourage people to Google. There was this incredible article. It only came out after the book came out. I had no idea about this stuff when I was writing the book. But there was a scandal involving his father. I don't fully know the details of it. I don't want to repeat it in case they sue me for libel. But
yeah.
I recommend everybody Google Morgan McSweeney. I think it's the Morgan McSweeney and I have to think of the exact title. But basically, there is, if you look at Morgan McSweeney and Ireland or something like that, if you Google, it shows up. There's this article that's written, a couple of articles get written in Ireland after Starmer's elected. Most of them are like, how great it is to have Morgan McSweeney because he's going to represent, you know, he's going to represent some sort of Irish interest in government.
I don't know if
that's any truth. But then there's this work, it's this incredible long read going into his family's history, where his father was accused of financial fraud, and there was there's really quite astonishing things. So, I mean, McSweeney himself is I think he's like a fascinating character because he's a character who he's so fundamental to our politics. But as I say in the book, never been interviewed on camera.
No.
Never been interviewed by a journalist. Never gone on radio to explain his thoughts. And he runs the country and nobody knows what he thinks and contests his ideas, which is actually sort of fundamental to why everything is, you know, why they've struggled so much now is that, you know, prior to the election, nobody actually tested these people, scrutinized them in any sort of meaningful way. And as a result, you know, I think it's made them come into government thinking that everything's really easy. You need to push one or two buttons and, you know, pull the lever that says economic growth and it'll happen. Send the right signals to the market, right? And this is, you know, fundamentally unserious because people hadn't scrutinized these people at any level whatsoever, tested the ideas and be like, well, precisely how are you going to pull this lever? Why do you have a lever and the Tories, have a lever, but they didn't pull it? Why wouldn't the Tories pull the lever if they had it as well?
Your book is a part. What are your predictions for the future then, I guess? Oh, well, two things. How has your book been received? I mean, it was interesting. Probably it was fortuitous it came out now when more people, with the media, were more open to mentioning your book rather than just burying it, which they might have done before the election. And also, what are your predictions for the future?
Well, so the way the book has been received has been interesting, precisely because it's a different time. But also, I adopted a particular strategy for how to sort of get the book out there, which was to basically selectively leak a series of stories to sort of across the political spectrum in the press to sort of generate a bit of heat. And there was enough there that got attention, you know, getting Paul Overton to resign, for example, that it forced attention on the book. So it couldn't entirely be ignored, which is always what I was worried about, that it would come out and you know, it would maybe sort of circulate, you know, five people would buy the bookmarks in central London and nobody else would. And it sort of forced it into the mainstream in a way that couldn't necessarily be ignored. So it's reached that status. People talk about it. It's plainly in the conversation that people are having. It'll be interesting to see, you know, obviously there's been sort of favorable reviews on the left that have come out. I'm very interested to see how the mainstream responds to the book and how they deal with it. And if they even acknowledge it from like a review perspective. I don't know what's going to happen. In terms of predictions, I mean, the one thing I will say is that this book is not the end point of what I consider a longer term project, right? This book is, is the first part of informing the public about what I think are serious issues around good governance. And and I will be doing stuff subsequently about making sure that some of the case studies I deal with in this book are properly pursued by authorities, right? I think that we absolutely have to hold these bastards to account. And I will, you know, I have a plan to do what I can as much as possible to pursue these stories to their logical conclusion where I can. In terms of what's going to happen in the government, I mean, it's plain to me Starmer is
And it was McSweeney that was doing this briefing, was it, against Streeting? Although I've seen this theory that somewhere, which I think was in, like, even in the, I don't know where it was, that McSweeney, because he is closer ideologically to Streeting, that him briefing against Streeting was actually a way to actually foreground Streeting as the viable replacement for Starmer. Yeah. Is that correct?
The problem with all this stuff, right? As soon as you have a secret briefing and nobody knows who briefed it, then you basically invite crazy amounts of speculation.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Owen Jones's theory, and I tend to be sympathetic to this theory, is that basically this is a confected crisis in order to try and somehow create this perception in the public domain that Wes Streeting is at loggerheads with Morgan McSweeney and with Keir Starmer. And it's being done precisely because they want Wes Streeting to be elected the next leader. I mean, they've just seen, they've had a deputy leadership contest between Bridget Phillipson and Lucy Powell, who are basically indistinguishable, right? Yeah. In terms of, like, both, like, sometimes I can't even tell them apart, you know, when I see pictures of them. But in their political ideology, like, really, there's, like, nothing between these people, really. No. And actually, quite interestingly, they're both part of what I call the Labour Together. You know, they were part of this group of what they call eight brave MPs who'd been working with McSweeney for years. So they're part of the same ideological tradition. The only difference that was drawn between them, which got Lucy Powell to win over Bridget Phillipson, was that Lucy Powell was seen as anti the leader's office, or as like some sort of like rebellion vote. That if you're basically signalling that you're upset with Starmer and McSweeney if you vote for her. And I think they've seen in that like actually McSweeney and Starmer have, with the Labour membership, the people who actually vote for the next leader, they're toxic. So anybody who's too closely associated with McSweeney and Starmer is going to have a problem with membership. And the problem that they have is that McSweeney and Labour Together and Wes Streeting, let me rephrase that. It's Labour Together in particular has for ages now been bragging about how central Wes Streeting was to like all their various, all their work that they've been pursuing over the years. So it's been very hard for them to say that Wes Streeting has no connection to it. So they're trying to, you know, my reading is that there's an attempt to create this confected distance between Streeting and Starmer. But I mean, to be absolutely clear, that if Streeting is elected, ideologically, I don't see any difference between him and Starmer.
No.
I don't see anything that he'll do meaningfully that's any different. You know, he might be like signaling to the left on certain things, but I mean, honestly, what's he going to do? He's going to privatize the NHS even faster.
I mean, yeah. I always like that. I mean, it's also how deluded I think the media are. I think he's an attractive character. You know, the people that are in the Labour Party, they talk about his film style, good looks. And I think, well, what's the film? Predator 2. I mean, in what universe is that guy an attractive person?
He's not, you know, I think they overestimate how much the voting public will like him.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, there is something about Wes Streeting that doesn't translate to ordinary people. He's one of those people who reminds me a bit of Jess Phillips, who for a long time was held up by the media as like, oh, she is an incredible communicator. She is unbelievable. She's going to be the next leader. And if you remember during the 2020 leadership election, she ran and she was a disaster. It's like it's a total, utter disaster, right? Like on the stand, actually arguing with people. Fell apart in a heartbeat, sort of embarrassingly so, and fell out of the race very quickly. And I think Streeting is one of those same people who, you know, is probably a little bit slick on the morning rounds, has obviously done an incredibly good job at, like, you know, he is Labour factionalism insider politics through and through, right? This is his life. He has been in the Labour Party pretty much his whole life. His whole goal is basically to reach this position. And as a result, he's been extremely good at seducing and spending time fluffing the egos of various journalists around the world. So there's a sense in Westminster that, oh, this guy's really good. He's a really good communicator. I'm not sure that I see it. And actually, if you look at the polling within the Labour Party itself, within the Labour Party membership, I mean, he's about as, you know, you look at, you know, who the most popular cabinet ministers are and leaders are. I mean, you basically are right at the bottom. You have Liz Kendall because of the welfare reforms. Then you have Rachel Reeves. Then you have Keir Starmer. And then you have Wes Streeting.
Yeah.
The Labour membership can't stand this guy. Why do you think, you know, the Labour membership, which has now been whittled down to 200,000 people, 200,000 true believers, they don't like this guy. Why on earth do you think he's going to communicate with the public at large?
Yeah, yeah. I could talk about this book for hours and hours and hours. It's a magisterial work of political analysis. If you want to buy it, there's a link in the podcast description, which you can click on, which means that you will circumvent Amazon and will buy it in a much more ethical way. But I urge all of you to buy it. I mean, Paul, you wanted to say something else?
So one of the things we're doing is we're taking the book on tour. We had a great launch event in London recently, which is well attended. It was really fun and interesting. We have a event on the 8th in Manchester, the Friends Meeting House, on the 9th in Liverpool at the Quaker Meeting House, and then in Birmingham at the Priory Rooms as well. We're going to be advertising the events on Eventbrite. Standard ticket rate, I think it's going to be £5. We will have concessions as well, because I know that some people are struggling. So we'll definitely have quite a large amount of concession tickets available as well.
Yeah, but I'll comment. I mean, have you worked out the model? Are you going to have like an interlocutor in there, or what have you thought about how you're going to do it?
I mean, what we did was quite good in London. We had Richard Saunders, who was the host of it.
Yeah.
And then Faiza Shaheen, who was sort of in conversation with me.
Oh, right.
So maybe, and Andrew's going to be joining me. Andrew Feinstein will be joining me in these events. So maybe you, me, and Andrew.
That'd be powerful.
Maybe get one additional. I do like the idea of getting people who are local as well to speak a bit. So there's some good people in Manchester and Liverpool we're thinking of as well.
Yeah, I'll do Manchester, Liverpool, or Birmingham would be an easy one for me, because I could just do it and then come home, sort of thing.
Okay.
It's up to you, obviously, but I don't want
to. That'd be great. Amazing.
So you're on tour. You're going to do. I mean, I think that the live event is, you know, I mean, this we're, you know, in some ways we're there's a renaissance of, you know, people want to come to live events. You know, where there's where interesting things are being said. I did Comic-Con on Saturday with this,
right,
many people with ADHD dressed as Daleks. It was it was an interesting event. But anyway, it's the live author event, I think, is actually, they weren't dressed as Daleks, really. They were dressed as more interesting things.
Well, maybe if you would be willing to do one of our events dressed as a Dalek.
that would cover all the bases. Oh, well, of course, because I've been into... I should do it either as my character in the Indiana Jones movie that I was in, or as my character in... and I've got the beard for that, or as my character in Doctor Who. So, yeah, I'll do it dressed... Yeah, then we cover the entire waterfront there. We've got literally everybody.
Why don't we just advertise it as a Doctor Who event and then confuse the people to arrive?
Yes. Yes, Revelation of the McSweeneys. It's a new terrible menace to civilization and to the Doctor. These slimy creatures called McSweeneys, these ginger-coloured evil characters. I think we better stop now. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I do like that idea. Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, we have this sort of inside joke in the family about McSweeney is like a real like 19th century villain's name. You could imagine him like arriving at the gates of a city and the guard says, "What do you want at this time, McSweeney?"
Because also I was thinking before, which is, I mean, is that, Wes Streeting always reminds me of Uriah Heep from Dickens novels. Mm. That kind of oily kind of sycophant, I always think, is would be he could play Uriah Heep in Panto or something. I don't know. Again, this is thank Paul. This is an amazing book.
Yeah.
And I urge everybody to buy it by clicking on the link in the description, or go down to your local Left Wing bookshop, independent bookshop, buy it there. And hopefully I'll see you on the road, man.
Great. This is amazing. I'd love to see the Dartleg outfit. It's going to be great.
Well, what have I got? I could do it as one. I don't know if you probably before you came here, but I could do it as my failed warm up man, Bobby Chariot. I could be characters could I do? I could do, there was one of the photos again before your time, probably, but there's an episode of The Young Ones, and which I was signing photos of where I play. It's this very complicated storyline where I play a driving instructor from Johannesburg who's really the man from Radio. They've rented a video. This is all entirely archaic, really. But I'm pretending to be a driving instructor from Johannesburg, but I'm really a man called Harry the Bastard. So maybe I'll come as. It's a long story. Look it up.
Yeah.
So I'll come as Harry the Bastard.
I like
to
it.
Our live event. But thank you very much, Paul. It's great.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.